From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Usually, the more time foreign correspondents spend in the country they're reporting on, the deeper their coverage. But for news about Iraq, they have to rely on Iraqi stringers, as it's become increasingly risky for foreigners to step outside the barricaded walls of their hotels. This past Monday, what little sense of refuge remained inside the hotel walls was shattered as three suicide bombers drove into the Baghdad compound housing the Palestine and Sheraton hotels, home to many foreign correspondents. Guards stopped them before they could hit the actual buildings, but the vehicles did explode, killing at least 17 people. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's al-Qaeda in Iraq claimed responsibility in a website posting. Reporter Mark Danner was at the hotel compound just last week, and he says the attacks showed tremendous audacity.
It is probably, with the exception of the Green Zone itself, the most highly guarded site in Baghdad. And there's no way you can attack the Palestine and the Sheraton without knowing that you're attacking a key point of the foreign press. So it seems to me that one of the things they were probably trying to do was get maximum amount of attention by bombing this particular target. And of course, it did get enormous coverage.
In other words, since journalists in Iraq can't physically get to the attacks, the insurgents were bringing those attacks to the journalists' front door?
Well, that's a good way to put it. You know, you actually had film footage of these attacks shot from the hotel, some of the most dramatic footage that we've had out of Iraq in quite some time. And it's mainly because there were people in the hotel shooting what was going on from the windows. If I had to speculate, I would say that Zarqawi was using this attack to say, I am still here. I can get through the most dogged, most elaborate security procedures and precautions, and this interim government, this puppet of the Americans, cannot protect you.
But if getting the world's attention was their goal, isn't threatening the messenger an odd method of going about that?
Well, I think one thing is that the insurgency, though we like to talk about it as a single phenomenon, is actually a number of different groups that do not necessarily coordinate very closely between themselves. And that's one of the most dangerous parts about covering Iraq, that there isn't one disciplined leadership that is able to say, look, this is a dumb idea. We shouldn't hit journalists. We want them to cover what we're doing. If one of our goals is to affect, in the words of an American officer there, the will of the American public, then it's foolish for us to attack journalists because they are the tools by which we can get these images of destruction, chaos, the attacks, etc., before the American public and lessen their support for the war. Having said that, the numbers supporting the war are now in the low 30s in the United States. So it seems that one of the insurgents' goals is being achieved.
In most modern wars, journalists seem to have had a sort of immunity because both sides had some interest in getting the truth out. That immunity seems to wear thin in civil conflicts like Bosnia. In this case, in Iraq, it seems that any given journalist could be perceived as being aligned with one side or the other, depending on who they work for or depending on their ethnicity. And there seems to be no effort to use them to get out the truth.
Well, it seems to me that in the last year in particular, Zarqawi's group, for example, has decided that it's more useful to use Westerners and to some degree use journalists to get publicity with violence than it is necessary to use them to convey a message, or that at least directing violence against them, they seem to believe, will not end their function as message deliverers. I have to say also, though, that even journalists perceived perhaps to be more sympathetic to the cause of the insurgency, like Al Jazeera, for example, it's not as if these people are given carte blanche to walk around the country either. Everybody risks being kidnapped or killed.
I wonder if the importance of journalists as message bearers is diminished simply because of technology. The insurgents in Iraq can communicate with others, recruit others directly through the internet.
Well, that is true that various groups in the insurgency do have direct access to the internet, and the press itself, as the direct access that they have on the ground, has become increasingly constrained. has relied on the internet to get news of what's happening, to see the announcements that Zarqawi and other groups make claiming responsibility, and also in some cases to use videotapes of attacks, which are very frequently put up on the internet by these groups. So it's true that the monopoly on information that the traditional press has had has now been broken.
Mark, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Mark Danner teaches journalism and politics at both the University of California at Berkeley and Bard College. He's the author of most recently Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror.
Rosa Parks died Monday, a humble woman whose act of defiance helped galvanize the civil rights movement. Her story is the stuff of legend, a mixture of reality and myth. Here to help us unpack that legend and bring us closer to the whole truth of Rosa Parks is Tim Tyson, professor of Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Who was Rosa Parks when she refused to give up that bus seat in the winter of 1955?
She was a very unifying sort of person in the black community because she was a working-class woman who made clothing very well. And so she had friends all up and down the social scale. E.D. Nixon was the most important black political figure in Montgomery. And she was his best friend and secretary. He was the head of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and the NAACP, and she was the secretary for both of those organizations. She was well aware that they had been anticipating a bus boycott. She had been an activist for 13 or 14 years. She was in the habit of defying segregation on the buses.
There is a famous picture of her being fingerprinted in the Montgomery jailhouse, wearing this tweed suit and her hair pulled back and these rimless eyeglasses, looking very much the librarian. Was she cast because she, in fact, looked so prim?
No. She was just a politically aware and politically active woman. They were, in fact, looking for such a thing. Within a year, there had been a couple of cases of black women arrested on the buses who they almost had a boycott around, but who weren't just right in one way or another. And so they were sort of waiting for this case. They did not say, however, you know, Mrs. Parks, would you mind going and getting arrested on the bus today? We're ready to do the bus boycott. When she got arrested, the word went forth, and people in the community knew what would happen.
And yet, as recently as today, I'm speaking to you on Wednesday, the Washington Post, in its appreciation of Rosa Parks, referred very much to her as a seamstress and very little to her as an activist. It did nothing to squelch the myth that she was just one woman who on a certain day had had enough. Why do you suppose that that myth endures?
I think for some reason we are unwilling to honor people who are politically active. We want to honor people who just have had enough and sort of spontaneously won't take it anymore. But somehow if they get categorized as active citizens, which would be a positive way of saying it, as troublemakers, which is the way we often think about such persons, then somehow it becomes self-serving, part of a movement which we're less comfortable with. And I think that's just an American popular cultural narrative that we pick up very quickly. And indeed, that started very quickly after the bus boycott. They talked about her tired feet. That gets mentioned a lot more often than it should. She may have been a little bit tired, but that had nothing to do with the decision that she made.
In that same Washington Post obituary I read today, there was, it seemed, a palpable sense of disappointment that the myth is, in fact, a myth. Why are we so reluctant to let it go?
There's a sense in which Mrs. Parks is very important to our post-civil rights racial narrative because we really want a kind of sugar-coated civil rights movement that's about purity and interracial nonviolence. And so we don't really want to meet the real Rosa Parks. We don't, for example, want to know that in the late 1960s, Rosa Parks became a black nationalist and a great admirer of Malcolm X. I met Rosa Parks at the funeral of Robert F. Williams, who had fought the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina with a machine gun in the late 1950s and then fled to Cuba and had been a kind of international revolutionary icon of black power. Ms. Parks delivered the eulogy at his funeral. She talks in her autobiography and says that she never believed in nonviolence and that she was incapable of that herself and that she kept guns in her home to protect her family. But we want a little old lady with tired feet. You may have noticed we don't have a lot of pacifist white heroes. We prefer our black people meek and mild, I think.
Rosa Parks is, at this moment in history, I think, pretty much a household name. She's taught in all the schools. But there was a time, somewhat after the boycott, that she had kind of faded into obscurity. How did that happen, and how did she emerge from obscurity?
The cult of personality that grew up around Martin Luther King very quickly after the bus boycott, the media focused on him, and people like E.D. Nixon and Rosa Parks were really pushed out of the limelight. In fact, I've read a letter from E.D. Nixon in 1958 where he was really explaining quite bitterly that he had gotten Miss Parks out of jail, he had called a boycott, and that neither he nor Miss Parks had been invited to the third anniversary celebration of the Montgomery bus boycott's victory. But as the boycott itself became a kind of American landmark, then they began looking back at the civil rights movement, and Montgomery looms large, and you trace it to the root, and you've got this appealing story.
Lest we suggest that it was not an act of heroism, let's just recall that she was hounded out of Montgomery and had to flee under death threat 4 points north. Over the years, Rosa Parks has occasionally expressed irritation that the myth endures. But she also, in other ways, cultivated her iconic image. Was she ambivalent about her place in history?
I think she was a seasoned political activist who knew that it was useful for her to seem apolitical. But the myth was only useful, really, in 1955 and 1956. But as the years go by, of course, historians didn't do much better. We expect historians to dig a little deeper than just the politics of image. Of course, I think there's also a serious gender element to this, in that when male politicians are quite forceful, you know, we like that. I think we prefer our women to be demure and modest and unassuming and unaware.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks much.
Timothy Tyson is the author of Blood Done Signed My Name and is a professor of Afro-American history at the University of Wisconsin.
Coming up, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog or a slanderer. And when the internet got totally taken over by the man.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. About a year ago, a town councilman in Smyrna, Delaware, started reading about himself on a blog devoted to local politics. Unfortunately for him, what he read was none too laudatory. The blogger accused Councilman Patrick Cahill, among other things, of having an obvious mental deterioration and of being secretly gay. Cahill decided to sue the anonymous blogger for defamation. He appealed to the cable company hosting the blog to release the blogger's identity, but the blogger went to court to block the cable operator from cooperating. Earlier this month, the Delaware Supreme Court ruled in favor of the blogger, becoming the highest court in the land thus far to weigh in on the issue of internet anonymity. The decision has been praised by many media watchers, including University of Minnesota journalism professor Jane Kirtley, who joins me now. Jane, welcome back.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, can you just describe the kinds of things that were written about Councilman Cahill on this blog?
Well, this is what some would call robust political debate and what others would call character assassination.
Now, if I understand the ruling, had this blogger not said that the guy was paranoid and losing his grip on his sanity, but instead had said, I can prove that he took money from such and such a person as a bribe, or any other such allegation, then this could have turned out very differently.
Absolutely. There's a footnote in this opinion which makes clear that the court is not in any way saying that bloggers can say whatever they want on the internet and not worry about being sued for libel. What they are saying is that when you're engaging in speech that is clearly hyperbolic, that is clearly not intended to be taken as a literal statement of fact, that there has to be a lot of deference given to the freedom to express opinions in inflammatory ways.
There were instances of this going back to the Federalist Papers of citizens participating in controversial public debates by publishing anonymous opinions.
That's right. You know, there are those who have said that the internet has gotten us back to the first principles of the what the Supreme Court of the United States once called the lonely pamphleteer. Now everybody with a computer and a modem is the lonely pamphleteer. It's a long tradition we've had for more than 200 years that when we're criticizing those in power, we should have the right to do so without identifying who we are. Now, again, it's what you think. It's your opinion. If you start stating facts, that's another matter.
As we often see in the blogosphere, hyperbolic opinion can quickly coalesce into conventional wisdom. I'm curious if there is a point under this ruling where precisely the kind of opinion that this anonymous blogger was promulgating could be considered at some point defamation when it becomes accepted as truth.
That's an interesting question. Obviously, people can take statements of opinion and morph them into facts, but I think here we would look at the original posting, we would look at the context, which is something the Delaware Supreme Court did focus on here, and said nobody could have taken this literally. I mean, it's very similar to the case some years ago involving the Reverend Jerry Falwell and Larry Flint in Hustler magazine, where Larry Flint, in an ad parody, suggested that the Reverend Falwell's first sexual encounter was with his mother in an outhouse. It was clearly pure opinion, pure parody. The Supreme Court years ago, I mean back in the 1970s, said that pure opinion, particularly about public officials and public figures, has to enjoy absolute protection under the First Amendment. I think the same analysis would apply here.
What impact will the Supreme Court of a tiny little state have on jurisprudence around the country? Is this considered a precedent that other courts must be guided by?
Well, the fact is there's not a lot of precedent out there yet. So when the highest court of any state, regardless of size, issues a well-reasoned opinion, as I believe this one is, it's going to be something that courts in other states will take a look at. They're going to be looking not just at the strong embrace of this idea of anonymous speech, but also the fact that the court has set a very high standard of proof that if someone in a position of power wants to unmask a blogger, they're going to have to demonstrate that they're not just filing a frivolous suit that's really for the sake of unmasking the blogger, but that they have a genuine claim that a court could take seriously. One of the things that the court said is that one of the unique aspects of the internet is that the ability of people to respond to critical comments is much easier than in the mainstream media. So I think the Delaware Supreme Court would suggest a little self-help might be in order. Do your own blog, make your own posting, take the person on in his own environment in cyberspace.
All right, Jane. Well, once again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Jane Kirtley is the director of the Scylla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota.
So far, America's hegemony over the global internet has been a matter of course and tradition. governing through the Non-Governmental Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN. But just because it's always been that way doesn't mean it always will. Next month, the World Summit on the Information Society meets in Tunis. Think of it as high noon in cyberspace, the showdown between nations who found themselves standing eyeball to eyeball back at the first summit in Geneva of 2003. Kenneth Neil Couquier outlined the issues for Foreign Affairs magazine, and he joins us now from London. Kenneth, welcome to OTM.
Thank you, Brooke.
So we generally think of the Internet as a bottom-up, lawless world where what happens, happens because the people using the Internet make it happen. So what exactly is Internet governance in this context?
Well, Internet governance refers to the coordination of certain technical issues, the infrastructure by which the Internet works. Now, there's four areas, but one in particular is the domain name system. The domains such as IBM.com or Harvard.edu, someone has to run that last extension, the suffix, the .edu or the .com. For other countries, it's .fr for France or .cn for China. But some institution has to determine who is the appropriate entity to manage that. Is it the government of China that runs .cn or is it someone else?
So now we have ICANN, which is administering the domain system since 1998. It was deliberately set up as a non-governmental group, but it's obviously controlled by the United States.
Well, to say that it's controlled by the United States means to say that it's under the authority of the United States. That's a little bit different. The reason why is because although ICANN is managed and overseen by the Department of Commerce, the Department of Commerce, like the U.S. in many areas, takes a very hands-off approach. It allows for an industry-led ethos in terms of the policy development. Other countries don't share that same tradition. So when the U.S. manages the system, you can think of it as the U.S. taking control of it to see that industry leads and to see that there's a hands-off governmental approach. That's why the U.S. is retaining control.
So you've called it an experiment, a bottom-up, multi-stakeholder approach towards managing a global resource on a non-governmental basis. But do you think it's been a successful experiment?
It has and it hasn't. There's been lots of problems with ICANN. It's been documented for a while. They have processes that are a little bit erratic, and bad decisions get made frequently. On the other hand, at least it's been better than all the alternatives. If we were to have this huge international bureaucracy creating ICANN, trying to set technology policy, we're certain of one thing. The Internet won't grow as quickly and as unencumbered as it has been.
This summer, American officials, you say, preemptively issued a document that you described as a Monroe Doctrine for our time. What do you mean?
Well, the Monroe Doctrine gave European powers a warning, stay away from our hemisphere. It's our sphere of influence. That is to say that this was our domain and we should have a presumptive privilege on how it would be developed. Likewise, for the Internet, this is the same sort of signal. It's telling other governments, stay away because right now we run it and we are uneasy with having you get involved in that management.
And an editorial in the New York Times last weekend basically said, America started the Internet and, gold darn it, we should keep running it. But some nations have problems with that.
Yeah, it's not a sustainable position. Now, of course, in the short term and the medium term, it's the best position to have because it's going to lead to greater freedoms, or at least it's going to preserve the freedoms and the values of the Internet that we have today. But as the Internet becomes more and more a part of the fabric of everyday life and more governments have a claim to wanting to have a say in how it develops, there needs to be some sort of a mechanism to allow that control to happen, to be shared among the international community. Frankly, for the moment, no one's come up with a suitable system to do that, and for that reason, we're at this impasse.
You have countries like Brazil, France, China, and Iran standing on one side. You have U.S. standing on the other. What's going to happen at that showdown in Tunis?
What we're going to see in Tunis is a lot of saber rattling. Then what we'll probably see is a compromise. And the compromise will probably take the form of a forum in which the governments around the world, with the U.S. in support, will organize just a talking shop. It won't have any powers, but it'll be a place where all governments can get together to discuss these issues more.
So the various opponents in this battle will fire off their guns, but you don't expect anybody to get hit.
For the moment, there's not much other countries can do. They must basically be a part of today's internet, or they actually cut off their nose to spite their face. Over time, what they could do is they could unify themselves into a block and try to create a parallel system, at least in terms of the naming structure of the internet, and therefore wean themselves away from the U.S.'s ICANN internet and with the names that ICANN has approved. That would actually be a difficult thing for the technology industry. If you have a parallel standard, it creates extra costs for people, and it also might not interoperate perfectly, so you want to avoid that at all costs. Just the threat of that represents more than just saber-rattling. It represents a threat by other countries that America wants to avoid. That's the nature of the high noon.
Do you feel a certain nostalgia for the days before ICANN, before 1998?
Absolutely. In many ways, the days before 1998, when the internet was just a smaller little haven of academics and engineers, the internet was a much better internet, and better in the sense that decisions could be made very quickly, and they could be made for the right reasons, just technical reasons that were the best reasons, not for other reasons like vested interests and economic reasons.
Well, Kenneth, thank you very much.
Yeah, my pleasure, Brooke.
Kenneth Neal Cukier writes for The Economist. His piece, Who Will Control the Internet?, appears in the November-December edition of Foreign Affairs magazine. We just heard Mr. Cukier refer wistfully to the internet's early days when he says a haven of academics and engineers were at the helm. Bob Kahn, Larry Roberts, Vince Cerf, and John Postel are credited with inventing the internet, although modesty would most likely prevent any of them from actually admitting it. John Perry Barlow is a former lyricist for the Grateful Dead and co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He knew some of the cybersphere's eccentric progenitors, and he joins us now to talk about how one of them in particular might weigh in on the issue of internet governance. John, welcome to the show.
Hey.
Could you tell us the story of John Postel?
He was in charge of connecting domain names to IP addresses. What John Postel did was to make order of a particular part of the internet, and he did that beautifully. You know, the marvel is that the last time that that aspect of internet governance worked, a benign dictator in a cluttered office in a university was in charge, sitting barefoot, who looked like Moses.
He was a computer science professor, but as a grad student in the 60s, he was among the team who built the internet.
Yeah, well, he was, indeed. But he was also, more importantly, he was one of the people who everybody respected. You know, when I first encountered the internet, I thought, gosh, this is great. This is actually working, large working anarchy. Because, I mean, you know, I'm from Wyoming and a libertarian at least and an anarchist at best. And my friend Mitch Kapor, who also founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said, you know, inside every working anarchy, there's an old boy network, which depressed me at the time until I found out that the old boy network consisted of people like Jonathan Postel and many others who were really dedicated to some greater purpose, and they were so good at it.
What was their greater purpose?
Their greater purpose was connecting everybody to everybody.
Well, did it bother you that he was doing his work under the auspices of the Department of Defense?
Not at all. I didn't care who was paying him. Actually, the National Science Foundation was paying him for a good long time. And, you know, I think the University of Southern California was paying him for quite a while. I mean, it didn't really matter who was paying him or under whose auspices. It didn't matter at all.
At what point was the decision made that the administration of these domain names should move away from one bearded hippie and go to an organization called ICANN with representatives of the world sitting on its board?
Well, actually, John, you know, I think knew that he was dying. He certainly knew that it was getting harder and harder to justify his, you know, apparently arbitrary control of this matter. And he actually tried to set up the original form and content of ICANN, but died at a point when, you know, he had not actually transferred the torch in a full way.
So if he had the ability to live forever, there would never have been a need for ICANN at all?
Well, you know, there would have been all these major corporations that suddenly realized that they needed a McDonald's.com, General Motors.com, whatever. And, you know, it would have been tough for him to deal with things like cyber squatters who'd already decided to get GeneralMotors.com or whatever. It turned into a thing that had to do with property, and he knew that the Internet was not about property.
So if John Postel were alive today and he were attending the upcoming meeting in Tunis, what do you think he would tell them?
Oh, gosh. If John Postel were alive today and he came down to the meeting in Tunis, he would be like Moses coming down from the mountain, I swear. He would be so annoyed.
So how come he could do it and a summit of representatives of the world can't?
Because everybody respected him. There were many times where there were countries, you know, where there were various parties that felt like they ought to be in charge of administering the local domain name, right? He was really good at deciding who was going to have the bottom line in a lot of countries that he'd never been to and never would be to. He had a feeling about this stuff.
And so he did it from the gut?
Well, as far as I could tell, there are a number of people that I thought had such an insight into how this thing ought to be done. And fortunately, it was designed by people who understood it in a deep way. I still take faith in the fact that they're still there, but I worry a great deal. These guys are getting old, and they'll die. And then I don't know what we'll do.
Thank you so much.
It's been great talking to you, and also it's been great to remember Jonathan Postel, who was one of my heroes.
John Perry Barlow founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Up next, 50 years ago, when broadcasting was men's work, one trailblazing radio station had a double X chromosome.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Now! You say you're lonely. Said you cry the whole night through. Well, you can cry me a river. Cry me a river. 'Cause I cried a river over you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 50 years ago this weekend in Memphis, Tennessee, the nation's first all-girl radio station went on the air. Legendary music producer Sam Phillips launched the station with cash he made selling Elvis Presley's record contract to RCA. Billed as 1,000 beautiful watts programming with glamour, sparkle, spice, WHER brought women's voices to the airwaves as never before. To mark the golden anniversary, we present an excerpted version of a documentary about the station produced by the Kitchen Sisters, also legendary, for their series Lost and Found Sound.
Good morning. This is WHER Radio, America's first all-girl radio station, Memphis, Tennessee. WHER 1430 kilocycles with full power.
Now, we signed on October the 29th, 1955. The thing was, nobody knew that we were going to be all girl. Each girl thought she was going to be the only girl on the radio station. Dottie Abbott, who I hired as general manager, I told Dottie, and she almost shouted, "I don't believe you, Sam. I know you're crazy, but you're not that crazy." You know, I mean, she was just beside herself. You were invading man's territory. I mean, you were supposed to be a guest or something if you're going to do anything as a woman on radio.
This is WHER Radio, America's first all-girl radio station for sparkling, bright music.
I'm Becky Phillips, and I was one of the original WHER girls. At the first, Dottie Abbott was experienced. Marion Kiesker was experienced, and I had been in radio. The other girls were mostly new, like Barbara Gurley and Bobby Stout. And
my wife, Becky, that's how I met her in radio. We were both kids in high school. Worked part-time at a little station in Alabama, our hometown. I'm Sam Phillips, and I'd wanted a radio station all my life. Radio, to me, it's a living thing.
My name is Betty Berger. My career started in 1956 when I went to work for WHER. Sam's wife, Becky, has a beautiful radio voice. And I think Sam recognized that, thinking, well, what would that sound like? Women playing records and music and talking and saying commercials and doing the news. That's different.
There's more to the job of girl announcer than what you hear from your radio. The girls pick their own music, run their own control boards, plus looking after our remote control transmitter here at our studios. We have to take and log all transmitter readings every half hour, as well as keep a program log.
They had no experience whatsoever. You were in a big market at that time. Memphis, Tennessee was a big market even in the 50s.
WHBQ Time Center News from Memphis, the Mid-South.
Before I went to work for WHER, I worked for WDIA, which was the world's first black radio station. But I worked there as a copywriter. I was not an announcer. No white people as stars. They were all black.
Let me tell you about a biscuit baptized.
This is Donna Barlett. I remember in particular the flour ads, and I wrote spots.
You bake your biscuit with Martha White self-rising flour with hot rice. You got it?
And the reason I went there is that I wanted to be on the air, and I knew I could never be on the air at DIA.
11 minutes before 8 o'clock.
Tonight I know the kiss we share is sweet beyond compare, but will it stand the test? Time.
70 degrees under partly cloudy skies. This is WHER Radio in Memphis, the first station in the nation to feature all-girl radio personalities. 1430 on your dial.
My name is Kimmons Wilson, and I'm founder of Holiday Inns in Memphis, Tennessee, my hometown. There's a boy named Sam Phillips. He's the guy that discovered Elvis and Johnny Cash and a half a dozen other real big stars. He came to me. He had heard that I was a guy that would take a chance on most anything. Said, "Kimmons, I got an idea. I want to build an all-girl radio station." So he told me he could get this station built and put on the air for $25,000. I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the $25,000, and when we get it on the air and I get all my money back, you own half of it." I didn't have enough funds to build it and buy the equipment and everything without it encumbering Sun Records. I sold Elvis and signed a contract in October of 55. And we went on the air October 29.
We got a lot of pre-publicity out of that because it was an all-girl station, and we had sense enough to hire some good-looking girls. And I said, "Don't want to pay anything but love music. A man singing to a lady, a lady singing to a man."
I ain't gonna get those Sunday blues
no more.
We were lady disc jockeys, and we did an occasional newscast. I mean, you were queuing up a record with the right hand, and you were pushing the tape button with the left hand, and you were getting a remote come over the telephone line. We got a lot of attention just because we were a bunch of women banded together. We got invited to every party in town.
Here's a Monday morning beauty offer you simply can't afford to turn down, girls.
Music, glamour, homemaking, and news. WHER 1000 Beautiful Watts.
100% human hair wiglets for just $6.66.
Dottie Abbott, she was the one that was really the heart of the radio station. She was our boss.
Dottie wore black dresses. She walked around all the time with a cigarette dangling in her lip and ashes all down the front of her dresses.
And she would put a cigarette between her teeth and she would tell us, I want you girls to get out here now and sell some time. And she'd be straightening her blouse, and she had big boobs, and she would always be pulling at her girdle.
My name is Rena Franklin, WHER, 1956 through 1958. Mantovani came to Memphis. I remember interviewing Mantovani. You tried to get music that went with your time of day. Being record librarian, that was my job, was to listen to all the music. Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, June Christie. People sent us rock and roll music, of course, and we would get rid of it. And when I did the jazz program, I used Dave Brubeck's Take Five. And I think at that time, there certainly wasn't any other jazz program in Memphis.
Now, believe me, I love rock and roll. I loved it then, and I love it now. But I knew the concept we had for this station, that we were not going to use any of my great rock and roll records. This is how dedicated to the feel we wanted to get in that station. There was a dearth, an absolute dearth of album music. There was so much good music on the 12-inch LP that was not being played, especially daytime radio. We were only a daytime station, sun up to sundown.
Mr. Charlie Sullivan, the general manager of WHER, is the man in the life of all the WHER girls. He handles his 8-girl announcing staff beautifully.
The girls, always for the most part, are really sweet, cooperative, and hard workers, of course. Like all performers, some of the girls have their temperamental moments, but they wouldn't be good air personalities if they didn't try for perfection, which most of them do achieve.
Stay tuned to WHER for all the news as it happens.
The sound that we were projecting had very little to do with news, although we were at news twice an hour. It was kind of a surface approach until Marge. Marge made us newsworthy.
And good afternoon to you. My name is Marge Thrasher, and I'm your listener and moderator from now until 2 o'clock as WHER Radio turns our microphones over to you, the listeners.
Charlie
the
Sullivan called me to do this talk show. He said, Meg, I got just the thing for you. You don't want to stay home with those kids anymore. Anyway, I went on the air and had never heard a talk show. Nobody had talk radio. KDKA in Pittsburgh. And that was it. As far as I know, it was called Open Mic. You were on the air in a big glassed-in window, and everybody in town was listening.
Here on WHER.
Open Mic is operated with a 7-second delay in case we do need to delete portions of conversation or comment.
See, nobody knew what to do with talk radio, especially me. I said, Charlie, what makes you think somebody's going to call?
Are you there? Can you hear?
And he said, no, they'll call.
Oh, and I'm not getting any conversation. Hello? Can you push the last button all the way down?
Hello?
That's it. That puts you in contact with us.
This is WHER 1430 on your dial with studios in the beautiful mid-city building in Memphis.
This is Ray Sherman, United Press International in Memphis.
1,000 striking sanitation workers marched on Memphis City Hall this afternoon and demanded Mayor Henry Loeb hear their grievances.
I urge you to go to work. I promise you that we're working on a raise and have been before this.
Dr. Martin Luther King has urged the Memphis Negro community to engage in a general work stoppage.
I'm Jane Rodak, WHER. There was a garbage strike. Tempers were running high. People that weren't involved in it were angry that we were having all this garbage all over and nobody was collecting the garbage. Garbage workers trying to get fair compensation. It was just a very volatile time.
Tomorrow, the strike moves into the third day, and the mayor is expected to take emergency action. The workers are striking for higher pay. Many receive only the federal...
You are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wage.
King promised to return to Memphis Friday to lead a general work stoppage.
Memphis had this story about itself that everything was separate, but it was equal. And when that spotlight got turned on the segregated city that Memphis was, it was obvious it wasn't equal at all.
Then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now.
I remember standing at the news machine and watching the news tap out that Martin Luther King had just been shot.
Like anybody, I would like to live.
Marge was on the air, and I took her the paper, and I could not talk and tell her what I had in my hands. I couldn't talk.
I just want to do God's will.
I was on the air, and they chose open mic because of a big listening audience to pay respects. I can remember reading the prepared statement, then played a Mahalia Jackson hymn, and then I said, now we'll take calls. Oh. I said, good afternoon. This is open mic, and it was a lady. And she said, are you a nigger or a nigger lover? And hung up the phone. I thought, what? I was stunned. Charlie Sullivan was stunned. We had nothing on the air. I mean, this is dead silence. And I got up and walked out.
They attempted to turn one of the squad cars over.
On the way home, I saw people standing on the corner with shotguns. I'd never seen it before.
Mace was used, which is a chemical gas. Several arrests were...
If you're listening to Jane on your all-girl station, 6 minutes before 1 o'clock...
And know that I love you.
People started burning things and throwing things, and marches were happening. And marches had been happening, you know, peaceful, you know, demonstration marches, but these were angry marches. And Charlie would give us our little tape recorder and say, they're going to have a march on Beale Street this afternoon. Will you go and get a news report? And, of course, we all wanted to go.
We were on the air when people were calling to get interviews, you know, to find out what was going on. Of course, they chose us last because we didn't have any guys. You know, it was all women.
We were not known to be sharp broadcasters. We were lady disc jockeys. But even our station started having calls from all over the world.
After that happened, we had a daily topic because Charlie felt like it was risky to let people call up and vent their hatred from both sides, blacks and whites.
What I was wondering was, in a way that the black people could participate in your program.
Oh, yes, ma'am. We have many, many black people that participate in our program at this time. People who have a handicap.
The talk show was something that made a difference in this town. In the meantime, all around the talk show, we were still playing Ray Conniff. There were little dollops of political awareness wedged in between that.
And now the latest WHER worldwide and local news The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong have made their boldest strike of the Cambodian War.
Jackie Kelly, WHER from 67 to about 69. The president of the local chapter of National Organization for Women had worked on the station. She called me up one day and gave me a lot of trouble because the public service announcement started out, Mr. Employer. And see, I didn't think anything about that at that time, because Mr. Employer was pretty much what was out there.
Do you have an interest in radio or television broadcasting? If you have a normal voice and a genuine interest in becoming a professional broadcast announcer, disc jockey, newscaster...
America's first all-girls station was interesting when there were no women in broadcasting, but there were beginning to be women in broadcasting. I think they figured the novelty was going to wear off.
W.
H.
E.
R.
Everything changed. There were suddenly men at the station. They paired me with a gentleman named Dick Potter, and I played the fool, and he was the intellectual one.
All right, you ready?
Uh-huh.
This is for Elephant Stew.
Oh, come on, Dick. I thought you were serious.
As the women's movement came on and got strong and everything, WHER, they changed the call letters, put men on the air. I thought, well, isn't that strange? Here we are, women doing it, have been. Now they're going, there's no more of that. And then they called it We Radio, WWEE.
It was not, I'm telling you, it was not a novelty. WHER was an embryo because there wasn't anything else like it in the world.
We cordially invite you to stay tuned to WHER Radio all day, every day for sparkling, bright music, the latest worldwide news, and up-to-the-minute local and regional news.
Our look back at WHER was excerpted from the radio documentary by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Kevin Schlottman and Katie Holt. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.